On Sunday night, George Knapp is going to be off tomorrow night. Usually he does that show, but it just turns out there's some sort of technical issue. So I'm jumping in partly because he had such a good show lined up. So when they asked me, I was game. I love native Bigfoot stories, not legends by some people's accounts, but rather these are traditions. These are part of their belief systems in some cases. These Native American stories of Bigfoot encounters coming up tomorrow night. And in the first hour, Dave Cullen, the author of the definitive book on the shootings at Columbine called Columbine, has the scoop on one of the remaining questions answered. It wasn't in his original book. It will be added as an afterword coming up, but it was something that happened earlier in the week, and you'll hear about it coming up at the first hour tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. But more on the Poisoner's Handbook and the poisons that were everywhere in our environment and still are out there haunting us in our systems every day. You need to know about this next. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. The Poisoner's Handbook, Deborah Blum, science writer, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer. I meant to mention that earlier again. You know, what kind of car do you drive? Can I ask Deborah?
I drive a Chevy.
It would make a great hood ornament, that Pulitzer Prize paperweight.
I should put it on there, right?
Don't you think?
Or else I'll drill a hole through it and wear it around my neck. It'll be the ultimate jewelry.
Well, I think, yeah, that's what the kids call bling. I think that's you win in the bling wars on that. So we were talking about cyanide, and then I just want to get into some general discussion. There's so many different poisons that were being used back then, and then I'd like to hear more about how this is affecting us today. But in the case of cyanide, now that's one that, of course, we associate with Cyclone B, right, from World War II. This is very powerful stuff, and yet once more, this was not hard to get your hands on if you were interested in killing somebody back then.
That's right. It was used in all kinds of, they actually use cyanide some in medicines again. I have a bottle on my desk at work that's a medicine that contains both arsenic and cyanide.
Oh, how about that?
Drugstore, right?
That should take care of that little post-nasal drip you have.
You'll feel better after you finally get out of bed again.
Ever get out of bed.
Yes. But they used it to polish silver. And in fact, the two scientists I was looking at, Charles Norris, who was the first medical examiner in New York City, and Alexander Gettler, who was literally the first toxicologist in any city attached to a city in the United States. Gettler talked about the fact that people were constantly had these cyanide-based silver polishes, and they'd had a number of people who poisoned themselves. They'd go polish a kettle or something, and they had a cut on their hand. So if you really wanted to kill someone with cyanide, it was a snap to get.
Right. Was it arsenic or cyanide that was in flypaper?
It was arsenic.
Arsenic was
also a snap to get. Yeah.
Yeah. You could put there. You've got flypaper up all over your house with arsenic in it. But that just fascinating, really, that it was so prevalent. So who would be like? What was the archetypical cyanide killer of New York back in the Jazz Age?
Well, there was a lot of cyanide that people mailed to others that they didn't like. That was a popular method. And there was a lot of stir it into food. And, the one thing about cyanide that makes it really tricky if you're a homicidal killer is that it's a kind of unmistakable death. The way cyanide works is that it attaches to proteins in your blood that normally carry oxygen, and it likes those proteins. The proteins actually bond much more quickly to cyanide than to oxygen. So when you swallow cyanide, it gets into your bloodstream, and it literally just muscles the oxygen out. And you suffocate. It's an actual chemical suffocation. And So the classic image of someone who dies of cyanide poisoning is that they're kind of their skin turns blue from oxygen deprivation. Their lips are blue, and quite often, as this oxygen is sucked out of, as the oxygen is kind of sucked out of you, your muscles will go into convulsions. So when someone is poisoned by cyanide, it's not like arsenic. Arsenic, you really could, you know, slip into food at a kind of carefully calculated dose. And someone didn't get sick right away. You could even stir it into food over a long period of time and kind of mimic a slow degenerative illness. Cyanide, it kills you. It kills you pretty fast at the right dose, and anyone's going to look at that and say, oopsie, right? That's
right.
Got to be, that's definitely not an act of God. That's something more serious than that. So
well,
cyanide's never been the famous favorite homicidal poison.
And cyanide was directly tied again to the speakeasies, to the whiskey, right?
Right. Well, actually, the most interesting way that you found cyanide in whiskey, and this was to me, as a reporter, the sort of most shocking thing that I found in general was that the greatest or the most serious mass poisoner of the 1920s was the U.S. government, because during Prohibition, as people continued to defy, right, the 18th Amendment and the people who felt very strongly that drinking was a moral sin, the government got very frustrated. They had a problem, they realized, where crime syndicates were stealing industrial alcohol that's used to, like, sterilize medical instruments or for other purposes, and redistilling it and selling it to the different speakeasies. And the government was so frustrated by the fact that people were, you know, this whiskey's being stolen and people are still drinking it, that they finally said, okay, we'll really scare people off alcohol. We'll just put lots more poison in industrial alcohol. And then these bootleg chemists aren't going to be able to get it out. And they did that. One of the poisons they dumped into the alcohol was cyanide. And you had a real serious problem. They put other things in there, too. They also put mercury. They put a lot of methyl alcohol. But you saw this incredible response in which people are really dying at a great rate. In New York, they had several hundred, between 400 and 700 deaths one in a couple of years. And again, Charles Norris, who was then the professional medical examiner, was doing a national crusade. He wrote an article in, yeah, like a popular magazine. He called it Our Experiment in Extermination.
But, I mean, think about that then. As you say, it really is right. The government was responsible for all of these homicides. And you're saying 400 to 700. And I just, as you were talking, I just had to look up. I was just curious how many murders total, not murders by poisoning, but how many murders in general happened in New York in 2009. And I was just thinking, it's got to be. I mean, for a while there was fewer than, you know, I mean, like, looking at homicides from the years 2003 to 2009 in New York City, according to a story I pulled up from the New York Times, during that period, a six-year period in that region, there were 3,600 murders total over that period of time. You break that down over 6 years, you do whatever, and you start to see, my God, people were murdering at a much more amazing rate back in the Jazz Age, and getting away with it a lot more than they do now.
It was a very, violent time. And we have these images of Prohibition as like being, you know, the party decade. Everyone goes off to the speakeasies and they jazz around and smoke a few cigarettes and have a few cocktails. But it wasn't just that you had this sort of crazed response of the government to this lawless decade, right?
Right.
The way some people think that the government poisoning campaign killed more than 10,000 people nationwide. But because you had these crime syndicates who were making literally billions of dollars by distributing liquor, you saw the rise of the mafia-like organization in this country. And I actually described a couple of scenes in New York where you had Wild West shootouts in the street, people diving through the fronts of hats stores and things trying to get away from the flying bullets. I mean, it was a fascinating time, but sometimes you just took your life in your hand going outside.
It wasn't a myth. And in a time when we feel like we might be living in a more violent era, only 412 homicides total in 2009 in New York. Total 412. And that was, you could have done more than that just with poison, with an individual poison. Well, all right, then that brings us to the Hotel Margaret story, doesn't it? That was in the cyanide chapter.
That was in the cyanide chapter, and that involved something that, again, you see this very casual look of very lethal use of lethal things. So during that time period, one of the ways, sort of bizarre to think of it, that people were allowed to fumigate for pests was to use the gas hydrogen cyanide, which we all know is a really, really, really poisonous gas. They used it to fumigate ships. They occasionally would, fumigate ships for vermin. The sailors would go back in. Sailors would be killed because there'd be pockets of the gas in. The Hotel Margaret involved, a genuine locked door mystery. One day, the hotel staff goes to clean a room, opens the door, and the residents of this room are dead on the floor. And they call the police, and no one can figure out how this elderly couple die. They're collapsed on the floor, but there's no sign that they took poison. The police investigate poisonous alcohol. That wasn't it. They're looking for poisonous packages in the mail. Nothing. Everyone's completely stymied. And it turns out eventually that, in fact, they'd had a fumigator working in the basement below this apartment building. And the fumes from of hydrogen cyanide had come up the pipes and flooded the room and killed both of them. And it was quite a showy story because the hotel covered it up. They didn't want anyone to know that they killed their own residents.
Right. And who could blame them?
Yeah.
But again, that goes to show you what poisons were out there. Now, are there statistics available from any of the forensic data that was being collected about the amount of poison that would show up in a non-poison related cadaver at at some of these morgues where they would run liver tests or soft tissue tests and they would find out what kind of poisons were just floating around in the environment like that could accumulate within your body during this unregulated period?
Well, actually, to me, one of the more interesting ones is carbon monoxide, which is a poison that we still have quite a lot of problems with today. We've talked about before that I wrote this book, as well as telling the story of forensics, it's poison by poison, chapter by chapter. And so mentally, I think of it as both this great story of forensics, but also a handbook of poisons. And my subversive reason for doing that is, as you've mentioned, we still live in a fairly poisonous age. And I think we're all better off if we understand something of what's out there and how it works. And so carbon monoxide really starts building up in American cities in the 1920s. This is the era when the automobile is really becoming popular. And also they used a lot of what they called illuminating gas, which had a lot of carbon monoxide for gas stoves and even refrigerators and to heat. And so you get a couple of interesting things. You get a kind of ambient background of carbon monoxide where toxicologists, when they're looking at the blood levels of people who live in American cities, find that the carbon monoxide in the blood is 3 to 5 times as much of people in the country. And because the gas is so common, you get a real interesting kind of effect. There's a lot of accidental deaths as we have today. And in addition, you see poisoners realizing that this is such a common cause of death that it's really easy to cover up a carbon monoxide murder and pretend that it's, just an accident. And so one of the things that's so fascinating to me about poisoners is that they're very calculating killers, right? They never kill by impulse. And so you can have, someone loses their temper and they pick up a kitchen knife or a poker or they have a gun. We see this quite often, but a poisoner has to plan in advance. And so carbon monoxide is a great example of the way poisoners of the time calculated how to use a common poison, one that was around enough that you actually routinely saw it in people's bloodstreams, and take advantage of that.
Any idea of the number of poisons that are in our environment today that were also prevalent back then or vice versa?
Well, quite a few, actually. It's been interesting to me. I started doing this blog, which I called Speakeasy Science, because I'm so rooted in this time period, on chemistry and culture. So I'm more up than I was a little while ago on poisons of today. But carbon monoxide is still a poisonous substance that we have not figured out how to handle well. I saw, for instance, a report in one of the medical journals that we average about 50,000 accidental carbon monoxide poisonings a year. Now, those are, obviously not deaths. But we also see arsenic. Arsenic is mostly because it's a natural element. It's in rocks. We have areas of the United States, for instance, that have high levels of arsenic in water. The water runs through these rocks. So we definitely see that as well. There's still some use of cyanide in industrial purposes, but cyanide's much harder to get. And chloroform, not so much of a problem anymore. Wood alcohol, still, moonshining, still cooking away. I don't know if you saw this, but a few weeks ago, there were six members of Willie Nelson's band arrested in Tennessee, and one of the reasons was possession of moonshine.
I didn't see that.
So a lot of these things are still floating around there, plus...
Talk about methyl alcohol. What's the difference between methyl alcohol and wood alcohol?
Chemically, they're pretty much the same thing. Wood alcohol, in its first incarnation, was literally wood alcohol. They used to have, to make industrial alcohols, they would burn trees, char it down, and go put it through a process they called destructive distillation. And the moonshiners of the time would burn wood, they'd burn sawdust, they'd burn, I saw one where they were, drying out different weeds. So, but methyl alcohol, you actually can mix up the carbon and hydrogen and oxygen that goes into the alcohol synthetically.
That's a poison, though, too, methyl alcohol.
It's the same poison, except that it's made industrially, instead of, by using, quote, natural ingredients. So.
But that's what aspartame is. It's methanol.
There's some methanol and aspartame, that's right, in a very tiny amount. I mean, the reason you really want, it's not like you can avoid exposure to all of these substances, because we kind of live in an age that's built on industrial chemistry, everything from plastics to plastics to automobiles is built on industrial chemistry, but there are certain things that you really need to be aware of, that you need to keep your dose of this as small as you can get it. And methyl alcohol is one of them, because if you actually swallow methyl alcohol, you'll get a little buzz off it if you have enough of it. But what happens is your body metabolizes that into two really bad poisons, formaldehyde and formic acid. And you don't want those bubbling around inside you.
But if I'm drinking a Diet Coke, and I don't drink a lot of aspartame, but if I were to drink a Diet Coke, I am ingesting something which my body will metabolize as formaldehyde.
Right. And theoretically, there's so little methyl alcohol in that it shouldn't do too much harm. And,
too much.
Not too much.
Not too much.
I'm certainly not saying that diet sodas that have aspartame in them are going to kill you. But, if you know that there's a risk, this is common sense advice.
Okay. But I want to get back to that, because there is that story earlier in the week about the link between liver damage and diet sodas. And I kept reflecting back on the Poisoner's Handbook and drinking that poison ourselves. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. if you have a chance to tomorrow night, if you too also enjoy these great legends, which some people say is too dismissive to call stories, Native American traditions about Bigfoot, about Sasquatch, as just being a myth, then listen tomorrow night. You're going to love this. We'll get the latest research on that coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast in for George Knapp. And then we'll get your calls coming up on poisons in our society. I got to pick it up. I pulled the story of the liver and kidney damage reports that are linked to aspartame. And we'll start there with Deborah Blum coming up next. Could this be, you know, the accumulative effect of even just a little bit of poison in aspartame or equal? Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Just added another 50 people on my Facebook page as friends. Let me just say, you all are really good looking people. I gotta say, unless you're faking your photos, unless you're borrowing them from other people's web pages or something, you're a good looking bunch. The Poisoner's Handbook, Deborah Blum, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in the Jazz Age of New York. Let me back up for a second on that, because I pulled up the story. Too much diet soda can damage your kidney was the headline that went around in November. And then there's another study that was being done on the effect of liver and diet sodas and why they were saying that, you know, exactly what the connection was, they couldn't make it. But, you know, it makes you really suspicious when you read about how aspartame or equal breaks down into methanol, which is formaldehyde, which is obviously a poison. And even if it's just a trace amount, if you're drinking two or three pops a day, well, is it out of the realm of possibility that you're slowly damaging your organs, if not slowly poisoning yourself?
No, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility. Methanol is a bad poison. I looked at some of that connection too, and the part that actually alarmed me a little more is that the type of methanol that's produced when an aspartame-containing substance gets really hot is more dangerous. So, you know, a soda can that you leave in your car or your truck that warms up above 80 degrees, say, I can't imagine wanting to drink that. But if you
Well, how about this? If you're putting, I would have put equal in my coffee.
Yes. Yeah.
Until I went to Stevia, and now I only use Stevia now, but before I did, I wouldn't have blinked at putting equal in a cup of coffee.
And that's the thing. I would love to see a better study of that, because there is lots of evidence that when you get aspartame compounds really hot, you produce a more dangerous form of methanol. Now, given, you know, if you're having one cup of coffee and you sprinkle a little equal in it, it's probably not going to knock you out. If you're drinking 10 cups a day and you're putting several packets in a cup, then you're probably making a mistake.
This is not out of the realm of possibility for a lot of people. And this study that links diet sodas and kidney damage, of course, can't go back and look at the trucks. That's one thing if you leave a can in your own back seat or something like that. But you got to figure, these cross-country trucks in the summer spend a lot of time sitting in parking lots, idling in traffic. You know, it's not exactly cool, and they're not refrigerated trucks when they're delivering that pop.
You know, and one of the things that I think it's important for people to remember when we're talking about chemicals anyway, is that, you know, heat can often bring out the worst in a situation. For instance, you remember there's recently been all this upset over BPA and plastics, and one of the things that people started saying, like with your Nalgene bottle, is don't leave it in the car and get it hot. The heat causes the compound to leach out of the plastic into the water. So if you're like having drinks in your car, you want to be careful about the container, and if they're going to get hot, you want to be careful about what you're using. And that's just good advice, period.
Okay, and double that then. If you've got if you're drinking, let's say a diet, let's not always pick on Diet Coke. So we got a Diet Pepsi.
Okay.
And it's been sitting, like it was moved in a big old truck, and this big old truck's been sitting in the sun, and it's warm in there. So now you've got the plastic bottle that's giving off the VPO, and then you've got inside the aspartame, which is cooking up. Who should be surprised that we're slowly poisoning ourselves with all of these quote-unquote convenience drinks? And then when they did the study on diet sodas, did they also do a backup study to find out how many of those people were putting packets of Equal in their morning coffee?
Yeah, no, I didn't see that, and I think that's just a great question. You and I should get a study started.
Exactly. Well, you're the professor. I'll go get another master's, and I'll come to the University of Wisconsin. Deborah Blum is a professor of science journalism, as well as being a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a science writer. You know, there are other poisons that are out there in our environment. Typically, what it's like when they routinely autopsy somebody, like, what is it that they're worried about? I mean, if they see a trace evidence of arsenic, they're probably not thinking this person was poisoned. Do we all have a little bit of arsenic in us? Do we all have a little bit of cyanide? I mean, is it that prevalent?
That's a really good question. Cyanide, probably not, because it's a fairly volatile poison. So it's going to pass on through, metabolize out. Arsenic, on the other hand, if you had been in an area that had high levels of arsenic in the water, say, or if someone in your family was secretly stirring a little bit of it into your oatmeal, arsenic stays. It's a fascinating poison that way. It's the poison that, you know, when they dig up, you know, they're looking at Napoleon Bonaparte's hair, or at one point
right.
They dug up our ex-president Zachary Taylor, because there are all these rumors that he had been killed by arsenic. You can find it. And arsenic's a fascinating poison, too, because it actually preserves your tissues a little bit. So one of the things I read about in my book was arsenic mummification, that they would exhume bodies and find them lying there, you know, perfectly preserved. I've often wondered if arsenic poison was, you know, contributed to the old vampire rumors. You'd open up a coffin and the person would look like they'd just gone to sleep. That was quite common with severe arsenic poisoning.
Well, there's one thing we hear about today, and that's mercury that's mm-hmm. still in so much fish. And that the pregnant women are warned about, you know, eating too much fish, and the type of fish and where you get the fish will determine what kind of mercury is, and that mercury does not go away.
Right. Mercury is also a bioaccumulator, and mercury is a neurotoxin and a carcinogen. So, you know, they're starting to say now, especially with long-lived fish, like, you know, salmon, large fish, sea bass, that have a long time to sort of accumulate mercury in their tissues. No more than twice a week for anyone. Be careful of your fish sources again. I mean, I think we live, chemistry is to me the most beautiful and sinister of all sciences. And the more we're just aware of it, the better we can protect ourselves. So I think you're making some great points.
Well, and then, but mercury was one of those poisons that you write about in the Poisoner's Handbook, because that also, too, was one that was used frequently back before the rise of the forensic labs.
It was. It was in a lot of medications. It's so bizarre, but, you know, people really thought of it as, you know, a sort of a mercury pick you up.
Right.
And so strange. And people used it quite a bit, both homicidally and for suicides. And because it was so much around, people would sometimes just accidentally kill themselves with mercury medicines. There was one case I wrote about which involved a film starlet named Olive Thomas. She was married to Jack Pickford, who was the younger brother of a silent screen star, Mary Pickford. And they had this wild relationship. He was a complete womanizer. He developed syphilis, and his doctor prescribed mercury bichloride to put on the sores. And they were off on a makeup weekend in Paris, and she went into the bathroom at night to take her sleeping medicine and accidentally drank his mercury bichloride. Right. And he was actually a murder suspect after that. People were so sure that he just you know, wanted to be single again or something. But eventually the police concluded it was an accident. But
what would have happened if he had been putting mercury on his sores and then they were having makeup sex in that hotel room?
Don't you wonder about that?
Yeah.
The kind of constant contact with these poisons. No wonder they were
right.
So strange back then.
Exactly.
In the world.
But, you know, and mercury, I mean, you know this because this pops up in the news from time to time. Somebody will break an old thermometer mm-hmm. in a high school classroom and the entire building evacuates. And I can remember a time when I was in high school where we used to intentionally break thermometers to pool the mercury on the table and to play with it.
We did too. We used to push those little silver balls around.
Yeah. And they get people coming, they get hazmat suits clearing the science lab out. And I thought,
yes.
Oh my God, we were flicking the stuff at each other.
And, you know, there used to be like a disinfectant that you put on cuts that was called mercurochrome.
Right.
It was kind of a bright orange. Well, that had mercury in it.
Did it really? I wondered about that.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered about that.
So, yeah, I mean, I think we're still, some of these poisons, like mercury, we've learned to be really respectful of, and some, like aspirin. Say some of the constituents in aspartame, like methanol, we're still figuring out. So it's, you know, it's kind of a chemical jungle out there.
All right. So before we get to callers coming up next hour, give us a satisfying story from your book of how the first New York medical examiner and the first city hired toxicologist were able to start to get convictions and start to get, you know, positive results in courts for murderers, people who are either poisoning to try to, you know, knock off somebody for an inheritance or just because they wanted to see just what would happen if they put poisons in food. And they actually started to catch people.
Well, one of my favorite examples of that is an arsenic murderess. Her name was Fanny Crichton. And in the early 1920s, she murdered her 18-year-old brother, took out an insurance policy on him, and used a rat poison called Rough on Rats. I love that name.
I do too. I'm surprised that they still don't have Rough on Rats.
I know, because it's
like
so
a late-night commercial, you know.
Yes.
Rough on Rats, Rough on Rats. Yes. Available at Walgreens, Rough on Rats.
It's like such a good name, but
it
was about 10% soot and about 90% white arsenic, the arsenic powder. And she stirred it into his pudding at night until he died, and she got away with this completely. I mean, people knew a little bit about detecting arsenic, but they didn't know enough to figure out, you know, what were the impurities and where did this arsenic actually come from. And one of the things about successful poisoners, once they get away with it once, is they often persuade themselves they can do it again. So about about a decade later, Fanny Crichton pops up again, and she had killed a neighbor's wife, essentially, with arsenic again, this time in eggnog. And this time, Alexander Gettler, who was the city toxicologist, science had developed to such a degree that they could actually go back and say, this is definitely rough on rats. It's not only this kind of arsenic, but it contains these impurities. It's like mixed with this proportion of soot. They were able to track it down to the purchase. And this time, Fanny Crichton and her accomplice went to the electric chair. So you see this enormous shift within a fairly short period of time.
Was it Fanny Crichton in your book, whose husband was not responsible?
Right.
But originally he was charged, and then they found out that he didn't know that his wife was really just kind of a serial poisoner.
Yes, that's right. He was such an innocent, poor guy.
Yeah, but he was originally charged as an accomplice, and then they figured out, no, it's just her.
And it was just her. She was, when I write books, like, you know, I kind of get into the heads of the people, or I try to, you know, why would you do this?
Right.
And Fanny Crichton was the one person in my book who creeped me out so much that I had to turn off my computer and get out of the house and kind of shake her off. She was a bad guy.
And so often we find out, you know, that there are, That there are things that we have long since outlawed in this country. For example, carcinogens, even what we allow in something like cigarettes, we prevent them from being put, laced onto the cigarettes here. But in other parts of the world, where they don't have these kind of prohibitions, the tobacco companies do whatever the heck they want, and they put whatever they want in these cigarettes. And there are other examples of that. Do we find other cultures where you can still buy rough on rats, where other places around the world that still sell white arsenic over the countertop, no questions asked?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are still arsenic murders. I mean, there have been a few recently that I've tracked in Africa, say. You need really, it's not that I'm going to tell you that I think we need to, that anyone should totally rely on their government in whatever country to protect them.
Sure.
You know, it's smart
sure.
to look out yourself. But there are definitely places where it's really easy to get poisons like this under the counter, so to speak, that are much harder in countries like our own. Yeah, absolutely.
I just wonder who else has
them. Your coffee.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, in the Philippines or, like, other cultures. I wonder if we get to some phone calls coming up next hour, I wonder whether people who have lived abroad can reflect back on their poison experiences and whether or not, because of central governments that either are not strong enough to have that kind of influence or authority, or they don't want to, this is not part of the culture, what they have seen in other countries when it comes to the availability of poisons, or for that matter, the prevalence of a real medical examiner. Because I think we have a pretty high standard here, but I know for a fact that there are counties, if not maybe whole states, that still don't require coroners to be doctors. It's still a political position in a lot of places, and that may be changing, or they may actually even be doctors, even though they're not required to be. But I know that that's true still in pockets of the U.S., right?
Yes, it's absolutely true. There's a lot of places where coroner is an elected position or a appointed position. And I think that's actually true in parts of Wisconsin where I live.
It wouldn't surprise me. But I go back to that again. It seemed like the perfect storm in the poisoner's handbook between the weapon, the motive, and the opportunity, plus the lack of anybody to detect that a crime had ever happened. I wonder whether that's also true in other countries where you're more inclined to be able to still get away with poisoning at the rates you were able to get away with it in New York not that long ago, or for the rest of this country not that long ago, because they just don't have the enforcement. They don't have people there that can do the basic tissue tests that Alexander Gettler helped to pioneer.
I think that's right. And it's interesting, I do a Google alert on poison, and I worry that I'm turning into a dark, twisted person, but I do a daily Google alert on poison, and there's definitely certain countries that tend to pop. India, for instance, pops a lot. There's amazing access to poisons in India, I usually get several poison murder alerts a week out of that country. So, yeah, I think that's completely true. I think, for all the fact that people will make fun of the CSI shows, enjoy them but kind of make fun of them, we're lucky to have a good forensic network in this country.
And maybe, Deborah, maybe the reason why you react so strongly to Fannie Crayton is because you fear you are becoming her with all of this internet and poison stuff. You know, maybe that's a lesson for all of us. You can't read it too much. You can't spend too much time with it because it starts to get in your head a little bit. I know that's what it felt like for me when I was reading the Poisoner's Handbook. You start to understand the psychology of the poisoner too. It's so tempting, and it seems so easy to get rid of the people that you didn't want until forensic medicine came along and started to put an end to it. Well, what about you? Your experiences with poisons or with medical examiners around the world, or any other way you can relate to this story coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.